Welcome to the Cohort Sisters podcast, where we bring to life the stories, struggles, and successes of Black women navigating doctoral degree programs and their lives beyond the degree. I'm your host and the founder of Cohort Sisters, Dr. Ijeoma Kola. Cohort Sisters is an online global network empowering Black women pursuing doctoral degrees by providing resources, mentorship, and community. For more information, please visit our website at cohortsisters.com. Welcome back to the Cohort Sisters podcast. Our guest today is Dr. Adia Gooden, who is a licensed clinical psychologist, speaker, and host of the podcast Unconditionally Worthy. A former college counselor who recently opened up her own private practice, Dr. Gooden received her PhD in clinical community psychology from DePaul University after earning a bachelor's degree in psychology from Stanford University. In this episode, Dr. Gooden shares the benefit of having two parents who were also academics while navigating graduate school, why doing a doctoral program at an R2 institution was the best fit for her, and some of the positive and negative coping mechanisms she used to deal with low self-worth in graduate school. Let's get into our conversation. So welcome to the Cohort Sisters podcast, Dr. Adia Gooden. Excited to have you here with us today. I know people can't see us, but we're kind of like both wearing like orangey brown fall sweaters. So hope that you are warm. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, who you are, what you like to do outside of work, and then a little bit about the work that you do?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me. So I am a licensed clinical psychologist. I am a Black cisgendered heterosexual woman. And, you know, I'm a people person. So I like being with people. I like spending time with friends. I love dancing. That's definitely something I've done less during the pandemic, but I love going out dancing. I love taking dance classes. Those are some things that I really enjoy. I also like cooking and, you know, making things with my hands like that. I live in Chicago. I've been in Chicago for like 14 years now, which is kind of hard to believe, but I'm originally from Southern California. So I'm a Cali girl at heart. And in terms of my work, I do see clients. I have a small private practice, and most of my clients are people of color. Most of them are Black women. And I'm really passionate about helping people to embrace their unconditional self-worth. And so I do that through the therapy I provide. I do speaking. And then I also have two online courses, online programs that support people in their journeys to embracing their unconditional self-worth. And then the last thing I'll note, because it's very relevant, I think, to your audience, is that I have just wrapped up co-authoring a book on Black women and mental health that's really for sort of practitioners. And we think some Black women might want to read it and understand themselves, but it's sort of about the challenges that Black women experience as they navigate life and some of the things they can do to take care of their mental health and promote their mental wellness.
Okay. Yeah, we are definitely interested in all of that. I feel like there's been, and I don't know if this was maybe accelerated by the pandemic or highlighted during the pandemic, but I have noticed, and I love this for us, but I've definitely noticed within the Black community, there being this like renewed conversation or more forward conversation about the importance of mental health and self-care and letting go of this like strong Black woman narrative and like being like remembering that it's actually okay to like not be resilient sometimes. Like it's okay to not have to be the strong Black girl. And so I love that we are starting to have those conversations and really invest in our mental health and well-being. And I think part of that is also finding people like you, like Black therapists, Black female therapists who we feel like we can actually speak to and like be really open with. I started therapy about a month ago and I have a Black female therapist. I'm just like, this is so great. Like, this is fantastic. So I'm really glad that you are doing the work. Can you talk a little bit about how you got interested in psychology? Was it a pretty straightforward path for you, or did you kind of do other things before you started the journey of becoming a licensed therapist, but also someone with a doctoral degree?
Yeah. So I actually had a pretty straight path. I think there's sort of two main things that got me into this field. One is that I've always been interested in people. I've always been a people person. I've always been curious about people and wanted to help people. And so they're sort of naturally that aligns with psychology because you learn about people, you learn to understand what makes people tick and why people do the things they do. So that has always been an interest in mine. I sort of went to college knowing that I wanted to major in psychology, but I didn't know that I wanted to become a psychologist. But the other piece of my story is that both of my parents are actually clinical psychologists. So they both have doctor degrees in psychology. And so, you know, they never pushed me and said, oh, you should be a psychologist. But I do think that witnessing them have fulfilling and flexible careers. So they both went sort of the academic route. They taught and they were on faculty and then later administration for like graduate schools and professional schools. And they had private practices. So I sort of saw like, oh, you can do a lot of things. You can have a flexible career, those sorts of things. So I think witnessing that along with my interests definitely helped me to find psychology and clinical psychology specifically. And it's turned out to be a really great fit for me.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So from seeing your parents' lives and careers, what do you feel like their advice was actually helpful? Or like did the field of psychology or maybe the process of becoming a licensed therapist like change drastically I'm not sure how much older your parents are than you, but in whatever, how many ever decades passed between when they went through their career journeys, when they started their journeys and when you started, or were they super helpful in terms of like navigating the journey for you?
Yeah. I mean, it was an incredible privilege to have parents who knew academia and knew grad school like that. I just count that as a huge privilege and a huge blessing because I think that because they were like teaching graduate school, like they were, you know, on faculty as, you know, graduate school professors while I was applying and going through graduate school, not only were they able to sort of guide me to figure out this whole navigating academia, which can be very confusing and complicated and difficult, but they also understood what I was going through. And I think that's often a challenge that people experience when they're the first in their family to get a PhD is that people don't really understand what you're doing or like, why are you doing this? And why is it taking so long? And, you know, well, how long is your dissertation going to be? Right. Which is like, well, that's not really the point, you know? And so I just think having two people who kind of very intimately knew both from their own experience and because they were in that world when I was going through it, and I didn't, you know, go to either of their schools, but they sort of knew the world. I think that helped. I think what's interesting for me now is that I have left the academic world. And, you know, this is my first time not being affiliated with a major institution. And so, you know, I'm in the world of entrepreneurship now and kind of wanting to think about how to use my degree in a bit of a different way than either of them have. And so this is one of the first times when I'm sort of going out sort of beyond their areas of expertise, which has been interesting.
Yeah. And I am very interested to get into that a little bit later. But first, let's talk about the academic journey itself. So you majored in psychology in undergrad. Then what happened afterwards? How did you take us from you majoring into you applying and starting doctoral program?
Sure. So majored in psychology in undergrad. You know, I was doing a lot in undergrad. I was one of those. I was doing too much. I look back. I mean, I had a great experience, but I look back and I'm like, you could have chilled a little bit more. Like, you could have just had a little bit more fun.
Your parents were academic, so I feel like you didn't really have much hope.
You're right. That definitely affected things. And I was, you know, anxious and type A and all of those things, which is certainly part of my journey. But one of the things I didn't do a ton of, though, was research. So I sort of like, I did a little bit, but that was never my main thing. And so then when I figured out that I wanted to apply to graduate school, it was like the summer before my senior year. And I like had these conversations with my dad and he was super helpful. And I was like, okay, so I'm going to apply to graduate programs. And I was like, you kind of need some research experience. I don't have very much. So I did a little bit of scrambling to like get enough experience. And, you know, I think this worked out very well, but like I didn't have enough research grounding to get into a Research One program. And I think ultimately those programs probably wouldn't have been a great fit for me anyway, but you know, I wasn't going to get into, you know, some of the schools that I applied to that were heavy on the research. And I ended up, I only got into two programs, which is okay. And I ended up going to DePaul University, which, you know, we did research, right? But it wasn't super intense. And what I liked about that program was that there was a balance between the research and the clinical. And for me, that felt like that was a good fit because I liked research, but that was never going to be like my only thing, the thing that really got me up in the morning. And so I ended up going straight through. So, you know, applied my senior year, you know, took the GRE, sobbed when I got out of that exam. I was like, we'll see how this goes, you know, and I got into two programs, chose DePaul, and then I, you know, moved to Chicago and started graduate school at the age of, how old was I? I guess I was 22. So I was a baby. Now I
Babies. I'm like, oh my gosh, I was such a wee little thing. I also went straight through. So I completely feel you. So you left Southern California, you left like the tutelage of your parents, and you moved to Chicago, which is very cold. I'm surprised that you stayed.
Yeah.
But you moved to Chicago and then started grad school. What was your grad school program like? Was it a cohort system? Did you have a lot of other people who started with you? And then what was the mentorship like in the program?
Yeah, those are good questions. So yeah, Chicago was cold and I hated it for the first 4 years. I was like, I need to get out of here. So the fact that I am here is a little surprising, but it grew on me because there's a lot of great things about the city. But yeah, so DePaul had a cohort model. So we had sort of like two tracks in the clinical program. I did the clinical community program and there's a clinical child, but each program had like three students. So there were six of us and we were actually really close. I was super lucky. There was another Black woman from Southern California in my cohort, which was really cool. And we lived together our first year. And it was just, it was a really good cohort. One of the things I really loved about DePaul is that it's not competitive. Like it's very much collaborative. Like we used to be like, okay, so you do this reading and outline it, and I'll do that reading and outline it, and we're going to collaborate. And so it was a really nice space. I think DePaul also had a big emphasis on diversity before that was, I mean, this was, you know, like 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago. And so they had an emphasis on diversity and a value for diversity before it was a thing, right? Like before 2020.
Yeah.
So I think that was good, right? So the faculty mentorship was good. We had like the mentor style, advisor style. So you were sort of admitted into one advisor's lab and then you could work in other people's labs, but like you had one person. I think my faculty mentor was great. She was not warm and fuzzy, right? So she wasn't going to be a warm and fuzzy person, but she was like great at getting you published and paid attention, right? Like I think there are some advisors who like don't pay attention. And like you get far down the road and then they're like, why are you doing that? And you're like, I've been turning this into you. You've not been paying attention. You know, like, and now I'm a, you know, now I'm screwed. Right. So thankfully she paid attention. She believed in me. I wrote a master's thesis and my research in graduate school was very much focused on African-American adolescents. So my master's thesis was about, it was basically like attitudes that Black youth had that would make it more or less likely that they would affiliate with a gang. So it's part of a larger project. And, you know, I thought it was okay, but my thesis advisor, my advisor was like, you should, you know, publish it. And I kept submitting it and it got rejected like 8 times. And after like 5, I was like, all right, like, let's just call it what it is. Like, throw this away. And she was like, no, it's a great paper. Submit it, submit it, submit it, submit it. And, you know, she's a white woman. And I finally got it like accepted. This is after I graduated from graduate school. So, and it was like, they were like, this is excellent. It's going to be the lead paper in our journal. And I'm like, I didn't change this thing. Right. So things like that, like she was very supportive, helped me get through. DePaul also had like seminars. So a thesis seminar, a dissertation seminar, so that you weren't left alone when you were doing those things. So yeah, I would say, I mean, it was still hard. It was still graduate school, but overall, I feel like I had a good experience.
Can you talk a little bit about what it actually felt like to public or submit and be rejected and receive? I don't know if you got any revise and resubmits, or I guess the first eight were rejections, but can you talk a little bit about how you pushed anything aside, mentor, continue to send this out?
Yeah. I mean, that was hard for me. I mean, I think it's probably one of the reasons that I'm like not into publishing. So the thing is, I'm fine with feedback. And I think you can get some feedback and some revisions and some that are very helpful and help you to move like a paper forward. I remember getting an edit back or, you know, feedback, and they were like angry, like there were caps and there were exclamation points. And I was like, what did I do to you? Like, I'm really not like trying to harm you. And so I think the challenge with the process is that sometimes people read with a clear head and, you know, they give very balanced feedback that's very useful. And sometimes it becomes this outlet for people who are angry or they've been torn down or whatever to tear you down. And so, you know, I think having an advisor who was like, this is a good paper, keep submitting it. This is a good paper, keep submitting it, was incredibly helpful, because I would have stopped. Like, I would have just been like, all right, we're not going to keep this going. I think the other challenge I have, I'm not really telling you the positive. The other challenge I have is for me, I'm like, who's going to read this? You know what I mean? Like, so I think that's one of the reasons why I decided not to go on the academic track, because I was like, one of the primary currencies of academia is publishing. And that is one of the things I like the least. Like, I like writing, I like ideas, but the process of trying to get your work published can feel so difficult. And I don't know that I want to be in a system that like that is the gold standard. Like, that's what I'm going to be measured on. So I think for me, part of what is helpful is like finding a bigger like purpose for why you're doing this work. Interestingly, my dissertation I published, and like that was accepted on the first submission to like the top community psychology journal. And I remember being like, really? Are we all really going to take this? And interestingly, like I had done my own study for my dissertation. So my dissertation was about factors that help African-American adolescents to thrive. And what I had done is I had partnered with some Black churches on the south side of Chicago, and I had given each church a report about the findings for their young people, as well as recommendations about how they could support their young people to thrive. And so for me, that gave me a lot of meaning for the work and the project. So publishing it was a cherry on top, but it wasn't the main goal of the work that I was doing. And I think that really helped. And it probably came through, which is maybe one of the reasons why that one went so much better when I, you know, submitted it.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned a few things that I'm just really resonating, because like you, publishing, I really struggle with the publishing aspect. And it unfortunately is really like the pinnacle like factor that determines your quote unquote success if you decide to remain solely in academia. So one is like the practical element of the work that you're doing. And so I love that you were able to not only publish your dissertation, but provide those recommendations to the churches. But you said something, I don't know if you remember that you said it, but you said something about like, who reads academic publications? It's like 30 people, like so few people read this work. And so that's actually like my like number one problem with academic publishing is they put you through the ringer in order to get it published, like for not a soul to read it. And I do think that there's an element you talked about, like the anger. It's like some people just were angry when they were giving you feedback. I feel like we don't talk enough about the elements of like hazing that exist in academia, you know, because obviously, like, there are gatekeepers. There's not enough space for everybody. So, like, there's this element that we have to weed people out, like, by being overly mean, by giving all of this, like, really harsh feedback, when it actually just doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be that way. So, but it does sound like you had a really supportive mentor, which is really, really awesome. Were you able to find Black female mentors? Were there any Black female faculty in your department or on campus that you were able to connect with?
So I actually was lucky enough to work with a Black woman professor. So I worked in her lab part-time, and I also worked with my advisor. So that was really great. And she, you know, was submitting really big grants, so like to NIMH. So it was a really great opportunity to learn kind of everything that goes into writing big grants. And she was doing interventions, right? So she did interventions for African-American adolescents around depression, around well-being, things like that. So that was a really cool opportunity. And so she was on my dissertation committee. And then I also, we had to have a non-department faculty on our committee as well. So I also, there was another Black woman in the basically counseling education department at DePaul. And so she was also on my committee. So I was able to find other Black women in this space, which was really nice.
So you had a supportive mentor, you had some Black women in on your team, in your corner. What were some of the struggles, aside from publishing your master's thesis, what were some of the struggles that you encountered during your doctoral program?
You know, I think for me, a lot of the struggles were internal. So I have always been the type who's like a good student, right? Like, I like school. I'm good at getting things done. Like, if you tell me I have to do something, I'm going to do it, you know? So that was fine, right? And I'm pretty structured. And so I was able to sort of keep myself on track. But the challenge that I had was really coming into graduate school, not feeling good enough, not feeling worthy, and trying to use graduate school as an achievement to prove my worth, right? So that was a big thing. I remember, I think I was in my, it was either my second or third year. And I had sort of like, me and another classmate had decided, like, we're going to graduate in 4.78 years. Like, we were just, I don't know why, but we were like, we got to get out of here. We got to do it really quickly, right? And that was sort of, I think I had one classmate who finished in 5 years. And for clinical programs, you have to do a year-long internship. So you don't graduate after you do that until after you do that internship. So I was just like pushing myself. And I just remember one morning, it was just too much. I was so anxious. I was overwhelmed. I was just, you know, it was just too much for me, right? And that was a real struggle. So that was when I started going to therapy, which was incredibly helpful. But in general, feeling, you know, adjusting to Chicago was hard. Like, I had some friends that people that I knew but weren't close to from college who were also in Chicago that I connected with. But it takes a while to sort of build your community and build that close connection. So, you know, I felt lonely. I felt isolated. You know, I struggled with dating. That was another way that I tried to feel more worthy. And so I think those were sort of some of my biggest struggles in graduate school, was just kind of not feeling good enough. And even though on the outside things were fine, I was making it through the program. You know, I was anxious, I was stressed, I didn't have good boundaries, right? Like, I was working all the time, sort of nonstop, overworking. And I wasn't taking really good care of myself, I would say. So I would say those were some of the biggest challenges that I had when I was in graduate school.
Yeah. And so then ultimately, how long did it take you to finish?
So I finished in 6 years, which is very reasonable.
Very. like perfectly reasonable. Fine,
yes. You know, I think going to therapy helped me like shift. And I think talking to my advisor and just like reaching sort of that breaking point, it was like, okay, like, yes, I may want to finish this in 5 years or whatever, but like, it's not necessary. It's making me feel crazy. Like, I just need to slow down. And it's right. It's not, it didn't take me 10 years, and it's okay if it takes you 10 years, but like, 6 is very reasonable. So yeah.
Yeah. Something that I was recently told in therapy, like, it's okay to just do less, like, just do less. Totally fine. So if you feel like, you know, you're on this self-imposed timeline, and obviously some timelines are externally impose if your funding is about to run out or something, then, you know, then you're running on a specific clock. But if you're just like, I'm going to finish in five because I want to, like, girl, sit down, just do less, just do less. So I now want to talk about your postdoctoral journey. And so towards when you were finishing up your doctoral program, did you entertain the idea of an academic career at any point? And then how did you eventually decide to pursue entrepreneurship?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. I'm like, what was I thinking? So when I was wrapping up graduate school, I knew, so I did an internship. So I did a clinical internship at the University of Southern California's Counseling Center. So I moved back to California for a year. And then I ended up getting a postdoc fellowship, a 2-year postdoc fellowship at the Family Institute at Northwestern. And at the Family Institute, it's an interesting place because it's affiliated with Northwestern and they have 2 master's programs that they run through there, and they do some research. So that was sort of like a, okay, like I could do this clinical and maybe somewhat researchy situation and also teach. And so while I was on postdoc, I sort of played around with, like, I taught a couple of courses and, you know, I did a little bit of research and I was also doing clinical work. And so I was sort of like toying around with, like, what's the combination of things I want to do? And then after the postdoc, I applied for 2 different types of jobs. I applied for, like, straight clinical jobs at university counseling centers because I liked working in that space. And then I also applied for some jobs that were more sort of community psychology oriented, which is research oriented, but it's very applied, right? So it's like an intervention in a community, or it's a program evaluation or something like that. And so there's some, like, research institutes, some of which are affiliated with universities, some of which are not, that, like, have those roles. I didn't get any of those jobs. Okay. So that was sort of like an answer. Like, yeah, again, the research thing is, like, not really, you're not doing enough of it. It's not going to work. And then I ended up getting a new university counseling job. And I loved that. And I did it for 4 years. And I think I liked being in a university space where there's learning going on and things like that. But I was really focused on helping undergraduate and graduate students. I was doing a lot of outreach work. I was supporting students from underrepresented groups. And so that felt good. And then I also started to feel like, I feel like there's something more, like I want to do something bigger. And so then I sort of, again, was kind of like, well, maybe I do want a faculty position and then I could do a private practice on the side. So then I applied to a few jobs and one of them was a faculty position. And, you know, it was at sort of a smaller university and program. And I think through the process of applying, I was like, yeah, I don't want to do this, right? Because it was sort of conversation about, like, tenure and what's expected. And they're like, you could do all this community stuff. That would be so great. And then I'm like, okay, well, but how's tenure going to be evaluated? And it's like, well, publications, mm-hmm. you know, teaching, mm-hmm. service. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, so all this community stuff that I'd be doing that I would be excited about and that you would theoretically be excited about is, like, counts for, like, this much. For my, you know what I mean? And it's like, I don't think that makes sense, right? And so I think the process of, like, coming up with the research and doing all of that stuff, I was kind of like, yeah, I don't think I want to do this. Like, this just doesn't sit right with me. And then the position I ended up taking was, and I think I did I get an offer? I think I might've gotten an offer, which I'm like, okay. Like, we could have almost been in there, but I just decided it was a good fit. And so then mm-hmm. I ended up going back to the Family Institute and the role was an administrative role, but I also negotiated for a faculty appointment.
Okay.
And so I got sort of a faculty appointment through Department of Psychology because I sort of felt, I still was sort of like, I want a faculty appointment. Like, it's sexy and it's and it means I'm impressive. Right. So I did negotiate for that and I had to apply, right? Like, I had to, like, put forth my credentials and my experience, my publications and blah, blah, blah. All of that stuff was reviewed and was approved. And it's so interesting because by the time it was approved, I was like, I'm ready to leave.
You did all that work just to be like, never mind.
You know, I think in some ways it's like I needed to know that I could do it in order to decide that I didn't want to. And I think that's, it's often a question that I would ask when I was at the University of Counseling Center and ask my clients, like now it's like, just because you can, does that mean you want to? Because I think it's really easy to get caught up in, I have to prove that I can do it. I have to show that I can do it. I have to earn it. I have to, you know, all of this stuff. And it's like, what if we took that off the table and said, you can, right? You can do this if you want. Do you want to, right? Can you slow down enough to say, do I really want to do this? And when I slowed down, and part of that was the pandemic, part of it was before, but it was like, I don't want to do this. I don't like being an administrator. I don't like answering a million emails. I don't like red tape. I don't like people telling me what to do. I don't want to do this.
Yeah. So then you started your own thing. Tell us a little bit about your business, the courses, the podcast, everything you got going on, including the practice.
Yeah. So I took a big leap. I left my job in the end of February, 2021.
Yeah.
Yeah. When are we? So end of February, 2021, and started working for myself full time. And it's been great. I mean, it's challenging. You know, that first month I was like, I'm working harder than I've ever worked before, but it felt good to be focused on things that I felt mattered. Right. And so I do have a private practice, which has been really wonderful because I love doing the work and it also sustains me financially. It provides like a stable source of income, which is very helpful. And then I also have developed these online courses, right? Part of what's important to me is using my knowledge as a psychologist to help as many people as possible. And I can help people with therapy, but I'm usually seeing one person at a time. And so that's limited. And so I have two courses at this point. I launched one in the spring, which is called Unconditionally Worthy. And it's basically guiding people on their self-worth journeys, right? To forgive themselves and accept themselves and practice self-compassion and tune into their internal wisdom. And that was really incredible to kind of walk 15 people through that process. And then I launched a sort of smaller course that's supposed to be more accessible this fall, which is about building a healthy relationship with yourself. So it's been really fun, right? It's been really fun to translate things that I often share in therapy that I think are very helpful for people, that have been helpful in my own self-worth journey with people, and see their lives transform. So I've been doing those things. I have a podcast, which is called Unconditionally Worthy. And that's been a lot of fun. So I have solo episodes for the first season. Second season has solo and guest episodes. And we talk about self-worth. We talk about how self-worth intersects with a lot of different things that we go through in life. And it's really designed to support people on their self-worth journeys. And so it's been a great ride. It's been fun. I am surprised by how much I love working for myself and working from home and the flexibility and all the things that come from that.
So let's circle back sort of to what we started talking about at the beginning, which is, you know, your parents are like traditional academics in this world. So how did they take your decision to leave that space and go into entrepreneurship? And actually, before you answer that question, I just want to remind everyone about what you just said about just because you can do something doesn't mean that you should or that you want to. And I feel like I received that myself. So I just wanted to just remind people of that little highlighted point. But yes, would love to know like what your parents thought of your decision to leave academia.
You know, that's a good question. You know, my parents are interesting. They are lovely and wonderful in a lot of ways. But then there's some ways where I'm like, what's wrong with y'all fools? So, you know, I think like they're nervous for me, right? Like there's some anxiety around like, kind of how are you going to make money? And are you sure this is going to work? And my parents are not very heavy-handed. Like they're very like hands-off people in general. Like, well, maybe throw little things out there, but then you're going to make your own decision. So, you know, we had some conversations and they were sort of like, you're going to charge what? And, you know, what's into, you know, sort of stuff like that. And then I was upset with them because So I like, you know, left my job and I had my like first week on my own and I didn't hear from them. And I was like, what's going on here? Like, y'all can't call me. You know what I mean? And so I think there's something in there. I mean, I don't know totally, but the psychologist in me, the clinical psychologist says, what's happening there? Right. I think that there's probably a way in which they may feel like they don't know exactly how to help me, right? Or guide me anymore. And there was probably a lot of meaning around being able to guide me and knowing the world I was in and knowing it more than me and going before me. And I imagine that there's a little bit of like, how do we relate to you and what you're doing for work now that it's not like now that it's not in our wheelhouse. And so, you know, like we don't talk about it a ton. I'm sure I can ask them for help, right? But it is sort of interesting that there's sort of like a little bit of a silence around it. So I don't think that they're like angry or not proud or upset, but I think it's like I have ventured beyond and they're kind of like, okay.
Yeah. we don't know how to help our baby no more. Mm-hmm. So what do you see as the future of the work that you're doing? So are you still thinking about ways to do community involved research? Are you focusing on the clinical stuff right now? Yeah. Where do you see the business growing?
Yeah. So I think I have let go of the research piece. I am really focused on how do I get the message that you're unconditionally worthy out to as many people as possible. And my first focus is women of color. And, you know, sort of in general, I'm like, I want to spread that message far and wide. I think it's really needed in our world. So I'd love to sort of scale and expand my programs, my offerings, and be able to share this message with as many people. That's really what gives me a sense of purpose, gives me a sense of meaning, gets me excited. And so that's what I'm focusing on. And I think that feels really good to be the person who determines like what I can spend my time, energy, you know, on and what's valuable, right? I think one of the challenges I had in my last role is that I was doing some program evaluation and that was part of the agreement. It's that I would do program evaluation. I was like, great, like this is going to get me back into that world. And then that really wasn't valued by the people who were above me. And so it was like, I was spending a lot of time and energy on something that I was like, I think this is important. I think this is going to move something forward, but people didn't value it. So then I'm like, well, you know, why am I spending time and energy on it? And so I think to be in a position now where I can decide this is important and then I can see the transformation in people, that feels really empowering.
Yeah. Awesome. Final question. What is one piece of advice that you have for Black women who are going through it right now, who are in their doctoral programs, trying to get through? What's some advice that you have for them?
I think the first thing that comes to mind is like, remember who you are. And I think academia has a way of saying this is the right way to communicate, to know things, right? Like I find myself, even when we're writing our book, I'm like, I don't want to have to cite 5 sources to say that Black women experience this. Like they do, I've experienced it. Like, I don't want to have to do this, right? Like, so I just think there's this sense in academia, it's like, this is the right way to communicate. This is the right way to write. This is the right way to be. This is the right way to operate. And that is usually centered around upper class, white, cis, straight men. And it can be easy to sort of lose your sense of self, lose your power, lose your wisdom, lose your intuition as you try to fit into this system. And I think it's so important to remember that you have a deep well of wisdom within you, both from your experience, from what you have witnessed, right? There is a perspective that you bring that is incredibly powerful. And so it's so important to remember that, to not lose sight of that in the midst of feeling like this is the only thing that's valued in academia.
Great, great, great advice. So thank you so much, Dr. Gooden, for sharing your journey and your advice with us on the Cohort Sisters podcast. It was an honor to learn more about your work, and we'll definitely keep track of all of the different things that you have going on with your business, and definitely will support your new book.
Thanks so much. I appreciate you having me.
Thank you again for listening to this week's episode of the Cohort Sistas podcast. If you are a Black woman interested in joining the Cohort Sistas membership community, or you're looking for more information on how to support or partner with Cohort Sistas, please visit our website at www.cohortsistas.com. You can also find us on all social media platforms at Cohort Sistas. Don't forget to subscribe to the Cohort Sistas podcast and leave us a quick review wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for joining us this week, and we'll catch you in next week's episode.